Brilliance Audio presents Devoted by Dean Kuntz, performed by Eduardo Ballerini. All knowledge, the totality of all questions and all answers, is contained in the dog. Franz Kafka. We are alone, absolutely alone on this chance planet, and amid all the forms of life that surround us, not one, excepting the dog, has made an alliance with us. Maurice Maeterlinck. If you pick up a starving dog and make him prosperous, he will not bite you. This is the principal difference between a dog and a man. Mark Twain. A dog is the only thing on earth that loves you more than he loves himself. Josh Billings. Darker than darkness. Tuesday, 4 p.m. to Wednesday, 5 p.m. Chapter 1. 3 years after the accident, Megan Bookman's heart and mind were in a good place, although occasionally anxiety afflicted her, a feeling that time was running out, that a sinkhole might at any moment open under her. This wasn't intuition at work, but just the consequence of being widowed at 30. A love that she'd thought would endure, a man she'd believed would grow old with her. All was taken away without warning. This current sense that somewhere bells were tolling toward her final hour would pass. It always did. She stood in the doorway of her only child's bedroom, watching him at his computer with its array of associated equipment, as he researched whatever currently fascinated him. Woodrow Bookman, Woody to everyone, had never spoken a word in his 11 years of life. At birth and for a few years thereafter he cried, but not once since he'd turned 4 years old. He laughed, although seldom at anything that was said to him or at any comical sight. The cause of his amusement was often internal and a mystery to his mother. He had been diagnosed with a rare form of autism, although in truth the doctors didn't know what to make of him. Fortunately, he had none of the most challenging behavior associated with autism. He wasn't prone to emotional meltdowns, wasn't inflexible. As long as he was in the company of those he knew, he never recoiled when touched or suffered mentally from physical contact, though he found strangers suspect and often frightening. He listened intently to everything that was said to him, and he was at least as obedient as Megan had been in childhood. He didn't go to school, but neither was he homeschooled. Woody was the ultimate autodidact. He taught himself to read only a few months after his 4th birthday, and he was reading at a college level 3 years later. Megan loved Woody. How could she not? He had been conceived in love. His heart began beating as he formed within her. As far as she was concerned, it beat in sync with hers all these years later. Besides, he was as cute as any kid in a cookie commercial, and in his own way affectionate. Although he allowed himself to be hugged and kissed, he neither hugged nor kissed in return. At the most unexpected moments, however, he reached out and put a hand on hers, or he touched her jet-black hair and then his own, as though to say that he knew he had received it from her. He seldom made eye contact, but when he did, his eyes sometimes glimmered with unshed tears. Lest she think that he might be sad on these occasions, he always favored her with a smile, almost a grin. When she asked if his tears were happy tears, he nodded yes. But he could not, or would not, explain what made him happy. The difficulties of communication meant they couldn't share their lives to the fullest extent that Megan desired, which was a persistent sadness. This kid had broken her heart 1,000 times, but with his sweetness, it also healed it 1,000 times. She never wished that he were normal and not afflicted, for then he would have been a different boy. She loved him in spite of, in part because of, the challenging journey that they were taking together. Now, watching him from the doorway of his room, she said, "Is everything okay, Woody? Are you all right?" Although intently focused on his computer, his back to her, he raised his right arm full length, pointing at the ceiling with his index finger, a gesture that she had long ago learned was positive, and more or less meant, "I'm on the moon, Mom." "All right, then. It's 8 o'clock. Bed at 10. He made a whirling gesture with the raised index finger, and then his hand dropped back to the keyboard. Chapter 2 After saving the document that he'd titled The Son's Revenge, faithfully compiled evidence of monstrous evil, on which he'd been working for a long time, Woody Bookman, 11, switched off his computer and went into his ensuite bathroom and brushed his teeth with a battery-powered Sonicare toothbrush. He wasn't allowed to own a manually powered brush because he was an obsessive brusher who, left to his own devices, would scrub his teeth hard for 20 minutes. Over time, this habit would wear away his gums and require transplants. At 10, he had needed oral surgery to save 3 teeth on the lower left side. These days, periodontists used sterilized, irradiated tissue from cadavers for such repairs. Woody already had some dead guy's gum tissue around 3 teeth, and he didn't want more. Not that anything weird had happened because of the dead guy tissue. Woody didn't experience memory flashes of the donor's life, or have the urge to eat someone like on The Walking Dead. The transplant hadn't turned him into a zombie. Such an idea was stupid science. Woody was embarrassed for people who believed stupid science, which a lot of them did. He was also embarrassed for people who got angry over petty things, for people who called other people names, for people who were mean to animals. For a lot of reasons, a great many people made him embarrassed for them. He was embarrassed for himself, that he was a danger to his own teeth. The Sonicare had a 2-minute timer. You were never supposed to scrub with the bristles, but instead let the sound waves remove the plaque. Without the timer, Woody's mouth would have been a graveyard's worth of gum tissue. He was also embarrassed because sometimes he thought about kissing a girl, an act that never crossed his mind until recently. Kissing seemed gross, yuck, swamping spit. Something must be going wrong with him that he would yearn for it. He was also, yet again, it never stopped, embarrassed, because if he ever did ask some girl's permission to kiss her, he would never tell her about his dead guy gums, for fear she would vomit and run away. He'd lie by omission, which was mortifying to contemplate, because lying was a prime source of all human suffering. The word mortification could be defined as a painful sense of humiliation, worse than embarrassment. As long as he could remember, Woody had been embarrassed for himself and for other people. That was one reason he never talked. If he dared to talk, he'd tell people what they did that embarrassed him, and he'd tell them what he found embarrassing about himself, which was a long list. He was a mess. He really was. People didn't want to hear about what a mess he was or what a mess they were. But not to tell would be to lie by omission, and the thought of lying so mortified him that he became nauseous. Better to stay silent. Say nothing. And maybe people would like you. And if you didn't tell them what an embarrassing mess you were, maybe they wouldn't notice. One of the most embarrassing things about people was how unobservant they were. After he brushed his teeth, he went to bed and turned out the nightstand lamp. He wasn't afraid of the dark. There weren't ghosts or vampires or werewolves or anything like that, and there was zero chance that a dead guy might creep into the bedroom to take his gum tissue back. The only monsters were people. Not all people. Just some of them. Like those who had killed his father. Dad had been dead for 3 years, and no one had been put in prison for murder. Everyone still thought his death had been an accident. Woody knew better. Now that he had at last finished The Son's Revenge, faithfully compiled evidence of monstrous evil, those individuals responsible would be brought to justice. Woody was very smart. He'd been reading at a college level since he was 7 years old, which maybe didn't mean a whole lot, considering that many college graduates didn't seem to know anything. He was an accomplished computer hacker. During the past 2 years, he'd penetrated highly protected computer systems, in which he'd planted rootkits that allowed him to swim through their networks without their security becoming aware that a secret fish explored the data depths. His explorations had also led him into strange places on the dark web. Now, waiting for sleep, Woody encouraged himself to think of something pleasant. He was embarrassed when he imagined himself kissing a girl whom he had seen in a magazine photo. He tried to turn his mind to another subject, but he couldn't. He wondered if one day, a few years from now, he might meet a girl who'd had gum transplants, which would give them something in common. He had been kissed on the cheek and on the forehead, though not on the mouth, but had never kissed anyone in turn. If he met such a girl, maybe that would be a nice place to start. Chapter 3 Dorothy smelled of death. She was 76. She would be gone shortly after dawn. This was a hard truth. The world was a beautiful place, but it was full of hard truths. The live-in hospice care nurse, Rosa Leon, attended to her in the bedroom where Dorothy had slept most nights of her long life. Rosa smelled of life and strawberry-scented shampoo and the peppermint hard candies that she enjoyed. In this room, Dorothy and her late husband, Arthur, had made love and conceived one child, Jack. Arthur had been an accountant. He died at 67. Jack had died in a war at the age of 28. His parents outlived him by decades. Losing a child was the central tragedy of Dorothy's life. But she was proud of Jack, and resilient, and she carried on, living a life that mattered. Kip had never met Jack or Arthur. He knew them only because Dorothy had so often spoken of them. Rosa sat in an armchair, reading a paperback, unaware that death was en route. At the moment, Dorothy slept, sedated and without pain. Kip suffered when Dorothy was in serious pain. He had lived with her only 3 years, but he loved her desperately. It was his nature to love beyond reason. Before the moment of her passing might come, he needed to steel himself, prepare to deal with the loss. He went downstairs and out through his door, and onto the deep back deck to get some fresh air. The house stood about 20 feet above Lake Tahoe. A minimal tide lapped softly on the beach, and sharp-edged reflections of a scimitar moon shimmered across the rippled water. A mild breeze brought a rich melange of odors, pine trees, cedars, wood smoke from a fireplace, forest mast, wild mushrooms, squirrels, raccoons, and much more. Kip was also aware of a strange continuous murmur. He'd only recently begun to hear it. He'd first thought it might be tinnitus, with which he knew some people suffered. But it was not that. He could almost hear words in that strange unremitting flow, which came from somewhere to the west. West by northwest. After Dorothy died, Kip would need to investigate, find the source of the sound. He was grateful to have an immediate purpose. He descended from the deck to the yard to stare for a while at the stars, wondering. Although he was exceedingly smart, only Dorothy knew how smart, he had no idea what it all meant. Join the club. All the philosophers of history, much wiser than he, had failed to conceive a theory that satisfied everyone. Shortly after he returned to Dorothy's bedroom, she woke. Seeing Rosa reading a novel, Dorothy spoke in a frail voice, "Rosie, dear, you should read aloud to Kip." Humoring her patient, the nurse said, "Don't you think Dickens is beyond his grade level?" "Oh, not at all, not at all. He enjoyed Great Expectations when I read it to him, and he adored A Christmas Carol." Kip stood bedside, gazing up at her, wagging his tail. Dorothy patted the mattress, an invitation. Kip sprang onto the bed. Lying at her side, he rested his chin on her hip. She put one hand on his burly head and gently stroked his pendant ears, his coat of golden fur. Even with hateful death on the doorstep, sweet bliss found an equal home with grief in Kip's heart. Chapter 4 The two-lane blacktop is a dark snake slithering through the moon-washed paleness of the Utah wastelands. In the nearby empty vastness, small clusters of lights glimmer here and there in the distance, like extraterrestrial pod craft that have descended from the mothership on some nefarious mission. Traveling south out of the Provo suburbs into ever greater isolation, Lee Shackett dares not take Interstate 15. He uses less busy state highways, undivided federal highways when he must, anxious to put as much distance as possible between himself and the events at the Springville facility. If he has committed as much evil as any man in history, he has done it with the best intentions. He believes that those intentions matter more than the consequences of his actions. How could humanity have advanced from caves to orbiting space stations if all men and women were risk-averse. Some seek knowledge and rise to challenges at whatever cost, and because of them, progress is made. Anyway, all may be well in the end. The final result of the project is not yet known, only that it's gone wrong in mid-stage. Every scientific endeavor is marked by setbacks. Ultimately, failure can be the father of success if one learns from the errors made. Initially, however, he is treating this failure as absolute. He is driving neither his Tesla nor his Mercedes SL550, because eventually the authorities will be looking for him. He is tooling along in a fully loaded blood-red Dodge Demon that he purchased for $146,000 through an LLC based in the Cayman Islands, to which his name can't be linked even by the most determined investigator. The vehicle bears a Montana license plate. In the unlikely event that a connection between him and the car might be made by law enforcement, the GPS has been removed from the Dodge to prevent its location from being discovered by satellite. One of two suitcases in the trunk contains $100,000. Another $300,000 in $100 bills can be accessed by disengaging two pressure latches on the back of the front passenger seat, revealing a secret compartment. Sewn into the lining of his supple black leather jacket, which is cut like a sport coat, are 36 high-quality diamonds, worth $500,000 to any gem wholesaler. These assets are not intended to support him for the rest of his life. They are to be used to allow him to go to ground for a few months, until the furor over the Springville fiasco subsides, make his way out of the United States, and get safely to Costa Rica by an indirect route involving 5 countries and 3 identity changes. In Costa Rica, he owns a retreat under the name Ian Stonebridge, and he possesses a valid Swiss passport in that identity. He is the CEO of Refine, a multi-billion-dollar division of a mega-valued conglomerate. Few CEOs of multi-billion-dollar companies have the foresight to imagine a corporate crisis dire enough to require the preparation of a new identity, and the hiding away of sufficient capital overseas to sustain a high standard of living for decades to come. Shackett takes pride in the fact that he has been wise and discreet for a man so much younger than most other CEOs. He is 34, which isn't all that young for a guy in his position in an economic sector where companies have been founded by technology wizards who become billionaires in their 20s. He answers to Dorian Purcell, the chairman of the board of the parent company, who was a billionaire at 27 and is now 38, but Shackett himself is worth only $100 million. Dorian wanted the research at Springville to proceed at a breakneck pace. Shackett obliged, because were they to succeed in their primary project, stock options would make him a billionaire too, although probably not a multi-billionaire, while Dorian's $50 billion fortune would most likely double. The injustice of this unequal compensation causes Shackett to grind his teeth in his sleep. He often wakes with aching jaws. A mere billionaire is a nobody among the princes of high tech. In spite of their pretensions to social equality, many of this crowd are among the most class-conscious elite bigots the world has ever known. Lee Shackett despises them almost as much as he wants to be one of them. If he has to go into hiding for the rest of his life, with only a measly $100 million to sustain himself, he will have a lot of free time in which to plot the ruination of Purcell, and little or no inclination to do anything else. From the start, Lee Shackett has understood that, should something go very wrong, he will have to take the fall. Dorian Purcell will forever remain untouchable, an icon of the high-tech revolution. Nevertheless, now that Shackett is having to pay that price, he feels deceived, tricked, bamboozled. Driving through the early night, he is racked by anger and by self-pity and anxiety, but also by what he believes to be grief, an emotion that is new to him. 92 Refine employees are in the locked-down high-security facility near Springville, prevented from communicating with the outside world in their final hours of life. He's as pissed off at them as at Dorian. One of those geniuses, or several, has done something careless that sealed their fate and put him in this untenable position. Yet some are his friends, to the extent that a CEO can allow himself friends among those he must supervise, and their suffering, as it should, distresses him. During the building of that complex, He'd taken pains to ensure that the module containing his office and those of his immediate support staff, five others, would go into airtight lockdown 90 seconds after all of the labs were hermetically sealed in a crisis. When the alarm sounded, he assured his staff that they were safe, that they should stay at their posts, and he quietly departed. He had no choice but to lie to them. The alarm didn't announce impending disaster, but an immediate one. They are as contaminated as the researchers in the labs. Shacket is likewise contaminated, but in mortal circumstances like these, he isn't capable of lying to himself as easily as he lied to them. Anyway, he's always been clever about eluding the consequences of his mistakes. Maybe his luck will hold through one last escape. He'll soon be hunted, the quarry of legitimate authorities, but also of Dorian's ruthless cleanup crew. He hopes, in what he believes is a spirit of mercy and sorrow, that all employees at Springville will perish before any can bear witness against him. Chapter 5. When Rosa Leon went downstairs to make a sandwich for herself, Kip was alone with Dorothy. The lamplight was low, the shadows as smooth as still water, the stately pine beyond the window silvered with moonlight. She said, "I have arranged with Rosa that you will be with her when I've gone. She'll take good care of you." By way of acknowledgement, Kip thumped his tail 3 times on the mattress. 3 meant, "Yes, all right." 1 thump meant, "No," or, "That feels wrong." In truth, his destiny would take him elsewhere than with Rosa. No need, however, to distress Dorothy. "Short stuff, you have been a gift of no less value to me than my son Jack, or dear sweet Arthur." Kip raised his head from his mistress's hip to lick her pale hand, with which she so often smoothed his coat and fed him treats. "I wish together we might have found a way to solve the mystery of your origins." With a long sigh, Kip expressed agreement. "But in the end, our origins are all the same, born in the heart that shaped all that is." Kip yearned to say so much to her while time remained. Although his intelligence had somehow been enhanced to a human level, he lacked the vocal apparatus for speech. He could make many sounds, but none were words. She had devised a clever method of communication, but it was in a ground floor room, and she lacked the strength to go downstairs. It didn't matter. Everything he wanted to say to her had been said before. "I love you. I will miss you terribly. I will never forget you." "Dear child," she said, "let me look into your eyes." He adjusted himself, laid his head upon her breast, and met her loving gaze. "Your eyes and heart are as golden as your breed, dear Kip." Her eyes were blue and clear and deep. Chapter 6. Lee Shacket parks his Dodge Demon in a far corner of the lot at the Best Western Motel in the small town of Delta, Utah. Sitting in the car, he shaves off his immaculately trimmed beard, which he's had since he was 24. He washes his hands with a sanitizer and inserts non-prescription contact lenses to change his eyes from tungsten gray to brown. After pulling on a baseball cap to conceal most of his blonde hair, he heads south on State Route 257, transitions to Route 21, then to Route 130. After 125 miles, he arrives in Cedar City, where he registers at the Holiday Inn, using a driver's license and credit card in the name of Nathan Palmer. In his room, before dyeing his hair, he needs to know if the situation in the Springville facility has made it to cable news. Standing in front of the television, the first thing he sees is video taken near the end of the workday, before nightfall. When he'd fled, the lab complex hadn't been ablaze. The fire broke out minutes after his frantic departure. The ferocious flames tower 60 or 70 feet above the lab complex, from one end to the other. The blaze must have been triggered to obliterate the truth of what happened in that place. Without his knowledge, fuel of some kind and an ignition system must have been incorporated into the structure to ensure that all proof of the nature of the work being done there would never be discovered in the aftermath of a crisis. He has no doubt that the researchers were intentionally burned alive, incinerated, nothing but bones left, if even that, to deny the coroner evidence. Although they might have died anyway, in days or weeks, The profound cruelty of the incineration of the staff shocks Lee, and leaves him so weak in the legs that he needs to sit on the edge of the bed. He had abandoned those people to their fate, yes, but Dorian had decided their fate for them. There are degrees of evil, and Lee Shackett takes refuge in the thought that what he's done pales when compared to what his boss has done. Surely Dorian Purcell has secretly authorized this extreme measure, his idea of a failsafe. Dorian fancies himself a visionary, as does nearly everyone in the press who writes about him, and a true visionary knows that progress requires sacrifices, that what matters is not the short-term cost in lives and treasure, but the great benefit to humanity that will be achieved in the long term. To justify murdering tens of millions, Stalin is reputed to have said, "A single death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic." By comparison, 92 deaths might be to Dorian nothing more than a mere footnote to the great enterprise that has been undertaken at Refined Springville Laboratories and will be relaunched elsewhere a year from now. On the TV, a news anchor solemnly reports that the research being conducted at the facility involved seeking a revolutionary cure for cancer. This is a ridiculous lie, but the newsreader no doubt believes it. Cancer research isn't so dangerous as to require that it be conducted in a walled, isolated compound a mile from the last residences on the outskirts of a Provo, Utah suburb. However, in an age when news departments operate on tight budgets, many in the media tend to believe whatever they're told by any source they trust, reserving investigative journalism solely for those they find dishonorable or suspicious. In public, at least, Dorian Purcell holds all the right positions on issues that matter to the opinion makers, and is all but universally seen as one of the good guys. The preliminary official explanation for the fire is that the facility maintains its own dedicated power plant to minimize outages that would affect research projects, that the plant is fueled by natural gas, and that perhaps a leak under the foundation went undetected until the building was basically perched on a bomb. "Yeah, right," says Lee, switching off the TV. Later, having become a new brown-haired, brown-eyed, clean-shaven man, he goes out to dinner. Never a snob about food, he has happily eaten his share of Holiday Inn fare and the equivalent over the years, although on this occasion, nothing tastes appealing. The salad greens are bitter. The vegetables are vaguely metallic. The potatoes have no flavor. He is able to eat the chicken, but it isn't as savory as it ought to be. He craves something else, but doesn't know what might satisfy. Nothing on the menu holds any appeal for him. In his room again, he mixes spiced rum with Coca-Cola and drinks until he can sleep. At 3:30 in the morning, screaming, slick with cold sweat, he wakes from a nightmare of which he can remember not a single detail. The disorientation that is characteristic of dreams remains with him. At the windows, an otherworldly cobalt blue light leaks around the edges of the draperies, as though in the world beyond these walls, a silent catastrophe is emitting lethal radiation. He is sober, but the small room feels vast, the bed adrift on a sea of undulant shadows. When Lee throws back the covers and sits on the edge of the mattress, the floor crawls under his bare feet, as though carpeted by an insect horde. He fumbles with a nightstand lamp and finds the switch. Sudden low light beaches the floating bed and reveals no insects, yet the place is almost as shadowy as, and no less eerie than, it had been in the dark. After rising from the bed, he stands in indecision, certain that coiled within the nightmare had been an urgent presentiment of an onrushing evil that isn't merely a sleeper's fantasy, that is instead a truth on which he needs to act to save himself. But still, he has no memory of the dream. He settles in a chair, gripping the upholstered arms with both hands, rocking back and forth even though the chair isn't a rocker and doesn't move in sympathy with him. He can't seem to be still. He needs to move, as if to prove to himself that he's alive. In the nightmare, he recalls something now. He'd been trapped, paralyzed, wrapped tightly, as though cocooned, a white translucent material across his eyes, formless shadows swelling and receding, sounds rising and fading around him. With a shudder, he wonders if the spectrum of genetic material with which his cells have been contaminated might include that of some worm that dies only to be born anew from a cocoon. He was helpless in the dream, and lonely. He rocks ceaselessly in the unmoving armchair. He has immediate getaway money and an elegant residence in Costa Rica, and $100 million where no authorities can find it. But a profound loneliness makes him vulnerable, with no meaningful purpose. He feels powerless, as when he'd been a child under the iron rule of a violent alcoholic father and a mentally disturbed mother. He can't endure being powerless. He cannot tolerate it. In addition to the scientists at Springville, 2,200 Refine employees had answered to him. Now he has authority over no one. He had power, position, respect, 20 Tom Ford suits that he wore with colorful sneakers. All that is gone. He is alone. Only now does he realize that the worst of all miseries to afflict the human heart is loneliness. Lee Shackett has never been good at relationships. He's had girlfriends, hot ones. He's not a troll. Women like the way he looks. They admire his ambition. He has a sense of humor. He can dance. He has style. He's good in bed. He listens. But he's never been able to sustain a love affair. Sooner than later, each woman starts to seem inadequate, inauthentic in one way or another. The relationship begins to feel shallow, lacking worthwhile emotional nourishment, a mere teaspoon of romantic essence. Nevertheless, he always eventually feels as if he's drowning in that teaspoonful, suffocating, and he needs to escape. He's gone still in the armchair. His stillness alarms him, as if staying alive depends on remaining in motion. He thrusts to his feet and paces the room, increasingly anxious. Something strange is happening to him. In the low lamplight, his restless reflection in the mirror is spectral, as if it's the spirit of some former guest who died here and is wanted neither upstairs nor down, who has nowhere to go. As he circles the room, he tries to recall when and where his life went wrong, not regarding the events at the labs, but prior to that. When had he last been truly happy? It seems important that he remember. When had his future been most promising? Although Lee has achieved great success with Dorian Purcell, each promotion comes with such a significant increase in stress that in spite of making a fortune, he can't honestly say he's been happier during these years than before. Even prior to Purcell, Lee hadn't always been in high spirits, but his prospects for happiness had been greater then. He'd had hope in those days. The options open to him had seemed infinite, whereas now he has few, perhaps only one. And he is alone. No one to listen. No one to understand. No one to care. No one who must answer to him. The turning point, the motive force that changed Lee's life, is Jason Bookman, a friend since college. Initially, Jason's career soared, while Lee's labored along. Then Jason brought him into Dorian Purcell's inner circle. As he paces, his reflection in the closet door mirror disturbs him. His face. Something strange is happening to his face. Something is wrong with it. He hurries into the bathroom, where the light is better. His eyes are brown, hair brown, beard gone. Maybe others won't recognize him, but he knows himself. His mud-brown glower is unimpressive when compared to the piercing tungsten gray stare with which he had cowed so many junior executives. Otherwise, he looks all right. But he doesn't feel all right. His face is as stiff as a mask. He works his facial muscles, yawning, puckering, grimacing. With his fingertips, he massages his chin and cheeks and brow, pinches his nose, pulls on his lips, searching for some wrongness. Finally, he decides that the stiffness is merely a consequence of anxiety. His body, too, is tight with apprehension. Jason Bookman changed Lee's life, which led to his current disastrous circumstances. However, the worst thing Jason did wasn't bringing him into Purcell's orbit. Worse, Jason married Megan. Gazing at himself in the bathroom mirror, Lee has an epiphany. Jason was so far-seeing, so aware of the long-term risks of working for a power-mad narcissist like Dorian Purcell, that he brought Lee into the company to serve as a fall guy, a role that otherwise might have gone to Jason. Why hasn't this been clear till now? Is he being unfair? Paranoid? No, no. What once seemed like an act of friendship is abruptly, belatedly revealed as a Machiavellian maneuver. It wasn't enough that Jason stole Megan from Lee. He also schemed to set up Lee to take the blame if things went wrong at Refine. Lee remembers the warmth of Megan's kiss. Megan Grassley, now Megan Bookman. Almost 14 years ago, they dated for 2 or 3 months. He'd never gotten more than a kiss from her. He was used to easy girls, and she insisted on commitment before sex. He decided to teach her a lesson by taking a break from her and going out with a hottie named Clarissa, so Megan would understand that servicing a man's needs was the best way to gain his commitment. But after a month, Jason began dating Megan. Eventually, they married. At the time, Lee hadn't blamed Jason for poaching. He was magnanimous. He wished the couple well and counseled himself that his friend would regret hooking up with such a frigid bitch. Evidently, however, Megan had no problem giving it up for Jason. They flourished together, and year by year she looked hotter, much hotter than Clarissa. Okay, no problem. Lee hadn't wanted her. She wasn't fast enough for him. She was a Honda, and he needed a Ferrari girl. He had better options than her. The world is full of good-looking women, especially when you're making 7 figures a year and piling up stock options. But now he is jobless, alone, soon to be an outlaw on the run. If he'd been more patient with Megan, she might have given herself to him. They might have married, and everything after that surely would have been far different from the current calamity. He suddenly knows when he had been happiest, when his future had been most promising, when he was dating Megan. Meeting his eyes in the mirror, he realizes that nothing is wrong with his face. The problem, if it is a problem, exists behind his face. Something is happening to his mind. There's a fever in his brain. If he purchased a thermometer, his temperature would prove to be normal. He has no doubt that it would be 98.6 precisely. However, there's a fever of excitement in his brain. Agitation, fermentation, effervescence. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. He's exhilarated, electrified, galvanized. He knows what he must do. He can't travel back in time 14 years and marry Megan, but he can go to her in California, where she lives now. She's a widow. 3 years a widow. She'll be easier now than she was when they were younger, ready for a new life, for the right life, the one that they would have had together if Jason Bookman hadn't come along. Lee will take her with him to Costa Rica. The boy, too, if she really wants to bother with a mentally disabled mute. Hot Megan and steamy Costa Rica. This prospect stimulates Lee, inflames him. He can be happy again, with a fine future that holds great promise. In the bathroom mirror, the reflection speaks to him, though it's not his image any longer, but somehow that of Jason Bookman, the poaching Machiavellian betrayer of friends. "You're infected," Jason declares. "They're swarming inside you. Something's going wrong with your mind." "Liar," Lee replies. "You just don't want me to get in her pants." He snatches up the pint of spiced rum and throws it. The shattering bottle fractures the mirror, instantly beheading and dismembering Jason Bookman. Daggers and dirks and stilettos and scimitars of glass spilling out of the frame, slashing down upon the sink and the faux marble encircling it, ringing like the silvery bells of some demonic fairy church. The aroma of spiced rum, orange peel, cinnamon, coconut, vanilla bean, spurts across Lee Shackett, splashes off the wall behind him. In a state of high excitement, 2 hours before dawn, he returns to the bedroom and quickly dresses for the long drive. Chapter 7. For a few hours, Dorothy phased in and out of sleep, her hand always on Kip, either still or caressing. He remained awake, alert to her condition, asking only for another minute of her company, another and another. Then she passed away. Kip smelled his mistress leaving first her flesh, and then the room. He cried the only way that his kind could cry, spilling not a tear, but issuing a series of thin, miserable whimpers. In tears, for she had loved Dorothy, Rosa said, "Oh, sweet Kip, please stop, please don't, you sound so pathetic, you're breaking my heart twice." But for the longest while he could not stop, because Dorothy had gone where he couldn't follow. He was not merely alone now. He was reduced to half of who he had been. Chapter 8. Woody never needed more than 5 hours of sleep. Perhaps he'd slept more when he'd been a fat-cheeked baby, but though he had an exceptional memory, he could recall nothing of his infancy other than a mobile that hung over his crib. Colorful lucite birds, coral pink, yellow, sapphire blue, circling around and around, casting cheerful prismatic patterns on the walls. Maybe the mobile was why, all these years later, he sometimes dreamed that he could fly. Medical authorities unanimously agreed that everyone needed 8 hours of sleep every night. Less sack time supposedly led to difficulty focusing the mind, disordered thought processes. Most people who wound up as vagrants or embezzlers or serial killers had perhaps been shaped by sleep deprivation. That was a theory, anyway. In Woody's case, however, if he languished in bed too long, that left him fuzzy-headed, with a lingering attention deficit. At 3:50 a.m., his eyelids flipped up with an almost audible click, and he became awake, with no chance whatsoever of falling back into sleep. This embarrassed him. He was different from other people in half a gajillion ways. If only he had needed 8 hours in the sheets, he would have been a little less alien. On this Wednesday morning, Woody did what he always did on arising. He had his routines. Routines were his salvation. The world was vast and complex, part of a larger and even more complex solar system, an enormous galaxy, an infinite universe, trillions of stars. And he didn't want to think too much about that. There were uncountable choices that were yours to make, innumerable things that could happen to you. The options could paralyze you with indecision, and all the threats could petrify you with fear. Routines made the infinite finite and manageable. So he took his usual 4-minute shower and dressed and went quietly downstairs. He was allowed to prepare his own breakfast cereal and toast, but it was too early to eat. Anyway, he liked to have breakfast with his mother when she got up for the day. He never spoke a word as they ate, but he enjoyed listening to her. Sometimes she didn't say much either, and that was okay too, as long as she wasn't quiet because she was sad. He always knew when she was sad. Her sadness passed through him like wind-blown sleet, and he became chilled into sadness too, which he otherwise never was. From a kitchen drawer, he received a Bell and Howell tact light and his trusty Atwood signal horn. The latter was a small aerosol can with a red plastic klaxon on top, which could produce an ear-splitting "wah" that reliably scared off potentially dangerous animals, though he had rarely seen any of those and had only used the horn twice. Thus equipped, he stepped to the security alarm keypad next to the back door. He entered the 4 numbers, and the recorded voice said, "System is disarmed." The volume was turned low, so that his mother wouldn't be awakened by anything but the alarm itself. The back porch offered a pair of teak chairs with thick blue cushions, a little table between them, a bench swing hanging from stainless steel chains, and darkness all around. Woody wasn't afraid of the night. The night could be magical. Cool things had happened to him in the dark morning hours while his mother still slept. Once he'd seen a fat opossum waddling across the lawn, trailed by her babies, all their tiny lantern eyes shining with curiosity when they saw him. He had seen foxes and countless rabbits and families of deer. The only thing he'd needed to scare away with a long blast of the horn had been raccoons that approached him hissing and baring their teeth. His faithful obedience had earned him the right to sit on the porch at night as long as he was careful to leave the door unlocked to facilitate a quick retreat. He wasn't permitted to venture into the yard alone. It was a deep yard, almost 3 acres, and at the farther end waited the forest. Animals more dangerous than mean raccoons lived in the forest. Mother Nature wasn't really motherly. Mom said nature was more like a bipolar aunt who treated you kindly most of the time, but now and then could be a real witch, conjuring killer storms and vicious animals, like big toothy mountain lions that, if given a menu, would always order tender children. He sat on the porch steps. His mother expected that he would sit in one of the chairs or on the swing or stand at the railing. But the steps put him closer to the action, if there should be any action, and he was still living by the rules, the primary one of which was that he should not go into the yard. The tact light lay beside him, unused, and he kept the air horn in his right hand. The moon floated in the west, not yet behind those mountains, as radiant as some exotic jellyfish in the sea of space, and the sky twinkled with more stars than Woody could count in a lifetime. After his father's death, murder, they moved from a busy town in Silicon Valley, which his mother said was more of a concept than it was a real place, and they came here to the outskirts of the community of Pine Haven, in Pine Haven County, where no city light pollution dimmed the stars. Woody was on the steps not more than 10 minutes when the three deer materialized out of the darkness, a buck bearing a magnificent rack of antlers, a doe, and a fawn that was maybe 5 months old and still wore a spotted coat. He'd lose his spots in winter, as he finished growing into an adult. Deer didn't always travel in families, often in small herds, and equally often alone. But the previous year, a family like this had visited almost nightly for 3 months, drawn by the sweet grass of the lawn. Woody had come to know them, quartered apples for them, and put the fruit on the porch steps and retreated to a chair. Gradually they had become confident enough to eat the apples off the bottom step while he had sat on the top one, and eventually, with their soft lips, they had taken the apples from his hands. These three visitors were not those from the prior year. Woody remembered the markings of those adults, and these were different. The deer were aware of him, and they were cautious, remaining at a distance as they grazed, their shadowy forms vaguely patinaed with moonlight. Sometimes he wondered what had happened to that other family. If one or more had been killed by hunters, if perhaps a mountain lion had gotten the doe or her fawn. Keeping a family together and safe was really, really hard. He didn't dare go into the kitchen and quarter a few apples and try to lure these new deer to the steps. Just by getting up, he might scare them away. If they returned a few times and became accustomed to his presence, he could begin to try to make friends with them. For the time being, watching them was pleasure enough. They enchanted him. They were beautiful and graceful, though neither their beauty nor grace was what most moved him. What fascinated, enthralled, spellbound him was that they were three, together and safe and grazing under the stars, unafraid in this world of fear, looking as though they would be together forever. The night lay so quiet that Woody imagined he could hear the stars burning light years away, though of course what he heard was the circulation of his blood through the capillaries in his ears. He whispered, "Hello." Although the boy's voice had been soft, the buck raised its antlered head to stare at him. They regarded each other for a long moment, and then Woody whispered, "I love you," because the deer couldn't spoil the moment with the wrong words, and because the gulf between their species ensured that neither of them could embarrass himself or the other. Chapter 9 Megan Bookman was awakened by the voice of the security system when Woody entered the disarming code. The volume was low through most of the house, so that he would not worry about waking her, but louder here in the master suite to ensure that she would always know when he had gone to the back porch. She got out of bed and eased through the gloom to the Crestron unit embedded in the wall. The screen brightened when she touched it, and she selected the word cameras from the menu. 14 two-camera modules were installed at points around the exterior of the house, one camera that could record either by daylight or outdoor lamps, and the other gathering infrared images, when as now there was neither sun nor landscape lighting. The system translated the red images into wavelengths that were nearest 555 nanometers, the green part of the spectrum to which the human eye was most sensitive. Nevertheless, the video offered little detail. Although she could see Woody sitting on the top step, gazing out at the backyard and the forest beyond, he was a pale green form among shadows of various shades of green, as if he might be a forest spirit, drawn by curiosity to this human habitat. He would have his Atwood signal horn and tack light. He never forgot those things. At the first suggestion of a threat, he would use the horn and bolt into the house. Megan had no concern that Woody might fail to recognize a threat. He feared strangers and anything with which his routine had not familiarized him. Pine Haven wasn't a hotbed of crime. Even the national drug epidemic had thus far not seriously sickened this quiet backwater. Their property was just beyond the limits of the town in which she had been born and raised, and she had come to feel safe here. Leaving Woody alone on the back porch wasn't ideal, but he was 11. And he cherished what independence his condition allowed him. She couldn't be at his side around the clock, and it wouldn't be good for either of them if she kept him close with a tether of fear as inhibiting as a leash. She returned to bed, where she would most likely need half an hour to go back to sleep. A small gun safe was attached to the bed rail. On retiring each night, she opened it for access to the weapon. On rising for the day, she'd lock it again. The pistol was a 9mm Heckler & Koch USP with a 10-round magazine. She had bought the gun a week after Jason died. She had taken shooting lessons from a former police officer who ran a self-defense school. 3 years later, she continued to practice regularly. Lying awake in the dark, she wondered if she really felt as safe as she claimed to be. Chapter 10. As far as Lee Shackett is concerned, Southwest Utah sucks. 60 miles of austere moonlit scenery on State Route 56 from Cedar City to the state line. As far from a Starbucks or a good sushi restaurant as anywhere on the planet. But he still believes it's necessary to travel by tertiary routes that are less policed than the interstates. Compared to southeast Nevada, however, Utah is a lush paradise. Toured via a series of two-lane back roads, Lincoln and Nye counties proved to be a hellish wasteland over which a fierce sun now rises like an omen of an impending thermonuclear holocaust. From the sleepy whistle stop called Caliente to the nowhere burg of Rachel, he races through 87 miles of Nevada nothing. The next town lies beyond another 54 miles of desolate land and lonely blacktop, a stretch of harakiri pavement on which rattlesnakes, bored and despairing, slither and lie waiting for the wheels of fate that will release them from the tedium of desert life. Miles in the distance, to either side of the highway, fester settlements with names like Hico and Ash Springs, served by state and county roads, and others like Tempute and Adavon, that can be reached only on unpaved tracks. At 6:50 a.m., he stops to fill the fuel tank at a combination service station and convenience store, that with a house behind it, stands alone at a crossroads a few miles short of Warm Springs. The gasoline at the two pumps is an overpriced brand he's never heard of, and the building housing the store is fissured pale yellow stucco with a blue ceramic tile roof. With his old life in ruins behind him, and his new life with Megan still far away in California, Shackett has been in a foul mood since leaving Cedar City. Mile by mile, the arid Mojave leeches out of him what little human kindness has not been drained away by the endless injustices he has suffered. The gas pumps aren't as old as the fossil fuel they provide, but they aren't of a generation that reads credit cards. He goes into the store to provide the cashier with his Nathan Palmer Visa to activate the pump. The man is evidently the owner, and Shackett despises him on sight. He's old and fat. He wears khaki pants with suspenders, a white t-shirt, and a narrow-brimmed straw hat, which seems like a costume, as if he is playing at being a desert bumpkin. After Shackett fills the tank, when he returns to the store to sign the visa form and get his card, the old guy says, "Beautiful morning, isn't it?" "Hot as a furnace," Shackett says.
"Well, you're not from here. To us, it's a mellow morning."
"How do you know I'm not from here?"
"Seen your plates when you pulled in. They're not Nevada. Looks like maybe Montana."
As Shackett signs the form, he says nothing. He concentrates on the signature, because for a moment he forgets the name that's on the credit card. He almost signs Lee Shackett. Something is wrong with his mind.
"Only 82 degrees, the cashier says. "That's cool for these parts this time of year."
Shackett gets the Nathan Palmer right. He meets the old guy's roomy eyes. "What parts are you talking about? Your private parts?"
"Excuse me?"
"Excuse you from what?" The cashier frowns and slides the Visa card across the counter.
"Well, you have a nice day."
Shackett doesn't understand the anger and contempt he feels for this stranger. It scares him a little, and is irresistible. "Excuse you from what?" Shackett asks again. This geezer pisses him off with his phony, howdy neighbor style.
"Did you fart? Excuse you from what?"
The cashier breaks eye contact.
"I didn't mean no offense."
"Did you offend me?"
"Sir, I truly don't believe I did."
A buzzing arises in Shackett's head, as if a hive of wasps has taken residence in his cerebellum.
"That's what you believe, is it?"
The cashier looks at the window, toward the pumps, maybe hoping another customer will drive in. Nothing is moving out there except a cloud shadow that slides a measure of darkness along the highway. The old guy's tension, his unexpressed fear, excites Shackett.
"Do you have a core belief?"
he asks, as he takes a candy bar from a display on the counter. Shackett himself once had core beliefs. A sense of limits. He's sure of it. He just can't remember what those limits were.
"What do you mean?"
the old man asks.
"Well, like, do you believe in God?"
"Yes, sir, I do."
"You do?"
"Yes, sir."
"Where is God?" Shackett asks, stripping the wrapper off the candy bar and letting it fall to the floor. The old guy meets his eyes again.
"Where is God?
I'm just wondering where you think he is."
"God is everywhere."
"Is he over there by the cooler with the beer and soda pop?"
The cashier says nothing. Shackett takes a bite of the candy bar, chews it twice, and then spits the sticky lump on the counter. "This thing tastes like shit. It's a decade past the expiration date. What's your God think of you selling shit like this? Doesn't he notice? Where is he? Is God maybe back there by the potato chips and Doritos?"
The cashier looks down at the credit card processor.
"I run your card. It's electronic. Over the phone is how it works. The number and name. They're out there at Visa already, the purchase."
He's telling Shackett that if something mortal happens here, there's proof that Nathan Palmer stopped for gas around the time that it all went down. But of course, Shackett is not Nathan Palmer. The angry buzzing in his head grows angrier. He needs to do something to stop the buzzing. He knows what he needs to do. He takes another bite of the candy bar and chews once and spits it on the counter.
"Is God over there by the magazines? You have some dirty magazines over there, don't you? Some skin magazines?"
A tremor has arisen at one corner of the fat old guy's mouth, which further excites Shackett. Yet the trembling reminds him of his grandfather, a kind man who had a tremor. Something that might be pity for the cashier overcomes him. It passes quickly.
"You're not much of a conversationalist, are you? You say it's a beautiful morning. Then you have nowhere to go after that."
Shackett throws the remainder of the candy bar at the old man, and it sticks to the white t-shirt. Shackett isn't Nathan Palmer, but he needs to use the Palmer driver's license and credit card for a while yet. If he'd paid cash, he could do what he needs to do to stop the buzzing.
"You're a lucky son of a bitch, aren't you?"
The old man does not reply.
"I said you're a lucky son of a bitch, aren't you?"
"Not that I've noticed."
"Not that you've noticed? Well, then you're as stupid as you are lucky. You're a lucky son of a bitch. It's your lucky day, Gramps. I'm going to walk out of here and let you go on breathing. You call the sheriff about this? You know what's going to happen?"
"I'm not calling nobody."
"Some cop pulls me over? You better kill me quick, because if he doesn't, I'll kill him. Then come back here and shove a pistol up your fat ass."
"I'm not calling nobody," the old man repeats.
Shackett walks out to the Dodge Demon. Under the driver's seat, snugged in a belt holster, is the Heckler & Koch Compact 38. He needs all of his willpower not to retrieve it, return to the store, and empty the magazine into the old man. On the road again, past the jerkwater called Warm Springs, heading toward Tonopah on Federal Highway 6, Shackett accelerates to 120 miles per hour. Then 130, the Dodge roaring, gobbling blacktop. He's agitated, excited, electrified, and he needs the speed to work off his agitation, to calm himself. Ever since Springville, Utah, something has been happening to his mind. For his entire life, there's been a Dorian Purcell to whom he has had to answer. A Purcell by one name or another, from whom he has taken shit when it is shoveled at him. Well, no longer. He is free at last. He's in control of his life. No one is the boss of him anymore. Something is happening to his mind, and he loves it. 35 miles from Warm Springs, about 10 miles short of Tonopah, the buzzing in his head stops, and he's able to slow down. The state line is maybe 90 miles away. He will soon be in California, on his way to lovely Megan. He's hungry. Nothing had tasted good at dinner the previous evening. He'd skipped breakfast. The candy bar really had tasted like shit. He's exceedingly hungry. Ravenous. He'll stop to eat as soon as he's in California. He doesn't know what he wants to eat. Nothing he can think of makes his mouth water. He'll figure it out when he gets there. The highway rises into the White Mountains and Inyo National Forest, the wastelands falling away behind him, the past falling away with him, the past and all restraints. Chapter 11. When the mortician came to collect the body, Kip at last got off Dorothy's bed. While others were too busy to notice him, he made his way down through the house, through his special door, and into the backyard. The September morning had come. The day was warm and bright and like unto other mornings, as if nothing terrible had happened. He howled silently, mentally howled to others in the Mysterium, that they might know his grief and share it, wherever they were, and on whatever task they might be engaged. There were only 86, all golden retrievers or Labradors. Now and then, a new young member found his or her way to others of their kind, for they could speak to one another on the wire, a mental communication medium unique to them. Their origin and history remained a deep mystery to them, but they sought to plumb it. They were dogs, unlike all other dogs, changed as only humankind had the power to reshape other species. But who had done it? Where had it been done? Why? And how had they come to be roaming a few counties in North and Central California in search of their meaning? On the wire, the peculiar murmur that wasn't tinnitus increased slightly in volume. Kip began to suspect that the insistent sound was not coming from some new member of the Mysterium, not from another canine. A human being. He thought it might be a young boy. This was a new thing. Kip had never heard such a call from a human being before. Then again, it wasn't really a call. The boy, if it was a boy, very likely didn't know he was transmitting. Kip stood for a while, looking at the house to which he'd been brought as a puppy. He expected to regret leaving it. But with Dorothy gone, it was just a house, no place special. She'd been 73 and in good health when she brought him home. She'd expected to outlive him. Then the cancer. He avoided leaving by the side of the house where the hearse was in the driveway. He didn't want to see her being taken away. The murmuring boy, if it was a boy, lived somewhere west by northwest of Lake Tahoe. As if it were a radio, he could turn off the wire. But then what would he do? He needed something to do. This might be a perilous journey for a stray dog, but Kip felt compelled to undertake it. He wasn't afraid of dog catchers. He was quicker and smarter than they were. However, the world was full of worse things than dog catchers. He set out at a trot, staying as best he could to back streets and forest service roads, to woods and meadows. From time to time he heard himself whimpering in grief. Love was the best thing when you had it, and the most terrible thing when it was taken away from you. Chapter 12. Wednesday afternoon, Megan Bookman was in her ground floor studio, listening to a Beethoven sonata, Pathétique, while working on a painting. The big windows provided good northern light. The room smelled of turpentine and stand oil and paint, a fragrance as lovely to her as was that of roses. She'd been painting most of her life, and had been selling her work since the year she graduated college. The glorious decade with Jason and the special needs of Woody had slowed her production, but she never stopped refining her intentions and techniques. When she lost Jason and faced the prospect of raising Woody alone, painting became the slow but sure curative for grief, as well as the means by which she gained the confidence to face the future unafraid. After a year of widowhood and long exhilarating hours in her studio, she had landed representation by a major gallery, with outlets in New York, Boston, Seattle, and Los Angeles. Her approach was a rejection of fashion art from Picasso to Kandinsky to Warhol, and an embrace of realism. Her subjects were from the world around her, rendered with meticulous fidelity, yet with a quirky sense of composition and a regard for the complexities of light that suggested something magical, even supernatural, about even the most mundane scenes. This wasn't an approach likely to win her critical acclaim in the blinkered world of critics steeped in postmodernism and all that sprang from it. Yet during the past 18 months, there had been positive, growing buzz about her work in the right places. She didn't care whether critical acclaim waxed or waned. She painted to satisfy herself. Her first life had ended with the death of Jason, and she was profoundly grateful to have discovered that there was life after life. Her art and her child were graces enough for her. Whatever else the future might bring would be a lanyap. Because she closely guarded her smartphone number, she also had a landline for the house. The studio extension stood on a table near her easel. When it rang, the caller's number meant nothing to her, but she put down her brush, swiveled on the stool, and answered it.
Hello?
Megan? Megan Bookman?
Speaking?
This is Lee Shackett. She didn't know quite what to say, though her high spirits sank slightly.
Lee, how have you been?
Terrific! I've been terrific!
He sounded a little manic. No complaints, none at all. How have you been? She dated him briefly, before she met Jason, but there was no chemistry between them, no intimacy. He was cute, earnest, he was amusing at times, in the hyperbolic style of the late comedian Robin Williams. He was hard-working, with big dreams that were charmingly naive rather than pretentious. But essentially he'd been a young man on the make, too into himself to care much about anyone else. Eventually Jason recognized enough intelligence and self-discipline in Lee's hustle to recommend him to Dorian Purcell. And indeed, Lee climbed the corporate ladder faster and far higher than Jason.
"I've been well," she said. "I've been painting. Being a mom, you know.
How's the kid? The boy? How's the boy doing?"
"Woody? He's fine. He's busy being Woody."
Megan hadn't had occasion to speak with Lee Shackett since a corporate event 8 or 9 years earlier. He had not called with condolences when Jason died.
"You've moved back to Pinehaven. That's where you were born, isn't it? Weren't you born in Pinehaven?"
"Yes, it's quiet here. It's a good environment for Woody."
"Not much happening in Pinehaven. Not a lot of glamour."
"Just how I like it," she said, wondering what motivated him to call, what he might want.
"Are you financially okay, Megan?"
The question struck her as bizarre.
"Excuse me?
I know Dorian didn't treat you properly after Jason died."
Jason had stock options that would have made her and Woody rich, if not wealthy. However, the employment contract had included an unusual vesting clause, allowing more than one interpretation, and Dorian had not been inclined to be generous to a widow.
"We're okay," she assured Sackett.
"It wasn't right. Dorian can be a hard-nosed son of a bitch. You should have sued him."
"He had way deeper pockets. It would have taken years and years, with no guarantee I'd win."
"It's just so wrong. Jason would have wanted you to sue. He'd earned what Dorian took from you."
"I was grieving, and there was Woody to worry about. We had enough. I didn't want to mess with the whole court thing."
"Dorian screwed me, too. He set me up, put me out on the ledge to take a fall for him, screwed me bad, but I still came out of it rich. I came out of it with $100 million.
She didn't know what to say to that. Shackett's voice had at first withered with acidic anger, but then it swelled with pride. Seemingly unaware of her moment of speechlessness, he hurried on.
"If you need anything, anything at all, you can count on me. I have resources. Whatever you need, anything."
She'd dated Lee Shackett maybe 6 times. She had seen in him a better boy than the man he'd become, one who adapted a cocky self-assurance to repress the humility and self-doubt of his youth. She might have liked him better if he'd let that boy become a different man. Lee had been out of her personal life for 13 years. A business associate of Jason's, whom she'd seldom encountered. There was nothing substantive between them. There never had been. She couldn't fathom the purpose of this weird conversation.
"That's kind of you, Lee. That's very thoughtful," she said, though in fact she found his offer not just inexplicable, but also somewhat creepy.
"However, Jason left us well set, with insurance and all, and my paintings have been selling. We're fine, we really are."
"When you make $100 million, he said, "you start thinking about giving back. I'm all the time thinking about giving back. I just want you to know that you and the kid, the boy, I just want you to know that I'm here for you. I care. I'm here."
Again, he left her speechless. He remained so oblivious of the effect he was having that he rambled on before Megan's uneasy silence became apparent to him.
"Have you ever been to Costa Rica? It's quite a place. Fabulous place. The blue Caribbean. Nothing like the sea along California. Tranquil, like a jewel. San Jose, the capital, is a sophisticated city. Friendly people, great nightlife. $100 million in Costa Rica is like $1 billion here. Hell, like $2 or $3 billion. I'm going down to Costa Rica, Megan. I'm getting out of the rat race. I'm going to lay back, enjoy life,
really live while I'm young. But nothing is as good as it ought to be when you're alone. What I need is someone to share it with. You and me, we had something special once. Really special. I was too callow, too frantic for success, too much of a jerk to realize what we had. But I've always regretted that we drifted apart. If you'll give me a second chance, you'll never regret it. I'll take good care of you, Megan. You and the boy. No one would ever take better care of you. She wondered if he was drunk, or high on something. He talked fast, but he didn't slur his words. Whether intoxicated or not, this out-of-the-blue proposal was irrational and profoundly awkward. She might once have been less than polite in this circumstance, but sweet Woody had taught her patience. She carefully considered her response. "I'm flattered that you thought so well of me all these years, Lee, though I'm sure I don't deserve it. Not only young men can be callow, young women make a good job of it, too. But I've got Woody. He relies on me. Woody is all I want for now, all I need. I couldn't possibly take him to Costa Rica. A trip to the barber shop emotionally exhausts him, and he needs days to recover from going to the dentist. I'm afraid you underestimate how a special needs child changes your life." His rapid speech gave way to a silence of his own. And then he said, "But it has to be Costa Rica. I've planned it all. The way is prepared. I can't change that now. I could fold you into the plan, you and the boy, but I couldn't come up with a new plan. Not now, not after. Give me a chance. Just tell me you'll think about it, Megan. Think about it overnight and call me tomorrow. Please, call me tomorrow." He gave her the number, and she wrote it down with no intention of calling him. "All right, but I'm afraid our time has passed, Lee. What's best for me is what's best for Woody, and that's not Costa Rica. You've made a life for yourself that anyone would envy, and I've no doubt you'll find someone to share it with. You deserve to be happy, happier than you'd be with me." He began to importune her again, and she lied to bring an end to this excruciating conversation. She said that Woody was calling out to her, that he was having one of his tantrums — Woody never had tantrums — and that she had to go to the boy right away. After hanging up, Megan turned her attention to the canvas on which she'd been working. Her own backyard served as the setting. The hour of the scene, perhaps 4 o'clock in the morning. Only the moon to illuminate the moment. This eerie luminosity was a metaphor for the light at the heart of the world, the unseen light in all things. Therefore, though its effects were rendered realistically, they were subtly exaggerated, so that the softest reflections of moon glow seemed to emanate from within certain pale elements of the composition, from the slices of apple in the boy's hand, from his face, from the soft coats of the three deer, from the white blossoms on the apple tree. The dark forest loomed over all. To the best of her knowledge, Woody had never ventured into the yard after dark alone. He had lured the deer to the porch steps to feed from his hand. Sometimes an artist had to stage events as they might have been, slightly different from how they had been, to best convey the truth of them. And what had been the truth of Lee Shackett's call? It eluded her. Unable to get back into the mood of the painting, she put her brush in a jar of turpentine. She went to the tall French doors and the flanking windows that provided her with ample north light. This was not the lawn in the painting, but the forest embraced this side yard as well, looming somewhat closer than at the back of the house. When a narcissist like Shackett had $100 million to fall back on, he didn't fall into melancholy under any circumstances, didn't become sentimental and brood about days gone by and all that might have been. He went out and bought what he wanted. Whether it was a Ferrari or a piece of arm candy with long legs and canyonesque cleavage. The explanation had to be inebriation. Wherever he was calling from, perhaps it was much later in the day than 3:30, and maybe he'd gotten an early start on the bottle. He hadn't been the kind of man who'd spoken of his heart, only of his opinions, which were dogma to him, and of his high ambitions, which he'd been certain would be fulfilled. He had never loved her, only wanted her. When the alcohol wore off, he would regret what he'd done. He wouldn't phone her again, and if he did, Megan wouldn't take the call. The quality of the light had changed, not just because the afternoon was waning, but also because the sky had begun to grow pale gray scales, its fine blue skin molting away in favor of a serpent's dress. As always, there was magic in the day, though not the kind to inspire in her the enchantment that she needed to do justice to the painting of Woody and the deer. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Verna Brickett came to do light housekeeping, which concluded with preparation of a meal that Megan could reheat for dinner.
By now, Verna would be at work in the kitchen. She welcomed an assistant cook, and Megan was good company. Megan cleared her brushes, put away her paints, and washed her hands in the bathroom that adjoined her studio. When she looked at herself in the mirror above the sink, she was surprised to see such unmistakable anxiety in her face, in her eyes. Lee Shackett's re-entry into her life had disturbed her more than she wanted to admit. Always he had hummed with a dark energy, the memory of which came back to her now by degrees. He had wanted one thing from her, and like a puppet master, he pulled strings with such finesse that in her youth and naivete, she had not at first felt him tugging on them. When she began to see through him, he tried using another girl as a weapon. What had her name been? Clarissa?